As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Welcome to the Phil Hay Show. It's brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan, joined from The Square Ball by Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And from The Athletic, of course. Here's Phil Hay.
Hello.
You can get signed up to The Athletic now. It's 33% off the full price of a sub if you go through our URL. You get all the analysis, in-depth features from the very best football writers around and ad-free versions of these podcasts too. Phil, this week, Pontus Janssen is going to be coming back to Elland Road. You've got a bit on him. What's the big question there?
The piece we're doing is looking at how Janssen has changed as a centre-back since he went from Leeds and asking the question of, is he more like a Bielsa defender now than he was when he went in 2000? And 19, has he evolved as a player? Is he a different player? What is he like, and what is he likely to do on Sunday?
And is he still wearing his cap in the canteen?
I suspect he probably is.
Yes, theathletic.com/LeedsPod to take advantage of the offer then. That's theathletic.com/LeedsPod for 33% off. And before we get to Brentford, before we talk about Calvin Phillips in the middle bit, let's talk about what's happened in the last 7 days, bring ourselves up to date in the football, and things looking rosier than they were before. A slightly more relaxed fan base, I think it's fair to say. And we're on for the 7 points potentially in the week that we were speaking about last week. If you haven't caught last week's show, go back and have a listen. And we made some varying levels of prediction, but 7 points was about the thrust of it. So it's potentially on.
I think I went for a win at Brighton and a draw with Palace, and it was obviously back to front in the end. If you're Bielsa, I think you're pretty happy coming out of those two games with 4 points. I don't think you could argue that you deserved more, but I think it is a right surge of impetus at the right time, exactly when they needed it. And it was pretty apparent that they needed to make something of this week. And I think they needed to make more of it than the 4 points that they've got. I still think they need a result from the Brentford game at the weekend. But these weeks are kind of odd in that they build up incrementally. So if you start well, they tend to finish well. If you start badly, it puts the pressure on the games that are coming. And I certainly got the sense that if it had gone wrong at Brighton, which it very nearly did, and if it had been a bad night against Crystal Palace, Brentford this weekend could have been one of those pretty horrific games where you turn up fearing that something's going to go on, which is really going to tip the place over the edge. But as it is, I just think the confidence will be on a different level after that Rafinha goal. I think, again, the stadium needed that. It's been quite hard going this season. Everybody's really dug in, I feel. I mean, the patience levels at Elland Road, I think, are higher than I've ever seen in the entire time that I've written about the club. And that is because Bielsa and the players have credit in the bank. There's absolutely no question about that. There have been managers and squads in the past who people have been waiting to turn on because they haven't been delivering. But the first sign of trouble this season hasn't led to any significant fallout. And suddenly the path to mid-table looks a lot clearer. You know, just with that one goal and that one penalty on Tuesday, you go from hovering around the bottom three and feeling that this season really is boiling down to survival and nothing more, to actually feeling that if you win on Sunday, the table looks pretty good.
It's been a round of games as well where results elsewhere have gone for us as well. Teams below us in the league have not been picking up wins. I felt like Norwich, Newcastle, that didn't help either of them. So it's allowed us to gather a bit of space there, hasn't it? Which is, it just gives us that comfort zone of knowing we're not going to be back in there within a game.
It has, although funnily on Tuesday, I was watching the Newcastle-Norwich result coming through and everything that was going on up there. And it was a bit wild, that game with the early red card and then Newcastle going ahead and not finishing it off. I didn't find myself thinking too much, that's a great result for Leeds, even though it was, because it almost doesn't feel like we've quite reached that stage yet of desperately looking elsewhere and thinking what's happening. But it was more a case of in the final minutes at Palace prior to the penalty, I really was starting to think to myself, irrespective of what we thought was coming from this season, it is 100% all about staying up now. You know, that's the stage that it's got to. And actually, it feels like these 14 games have drained so much from everybody that staying up and packing this season away will probably do quite nicely if that's the way it goes. So not quite that desperate, I don't think. But if you'd been coming out of Palace with 2 points from two games, Brentford becomes absolutely must win just because of what's coming afterwards. I still feel it is because it's a game that Leeds should win and need to win. But it does settle everything down. And as much as everybody is looking fraught and exhausted already and we're only just into December, I was joking with somebody on Tuesday night that it is actually important to have a bit of jeopardy in your football and to have something riding on it. And I know Moscow's spoken about this and we have as well, that it does feel like the season has been back to front these two. It was so calm last year and it was so orderly and always in control. And this season has been quite the opposite. But ultimately, they needed to amount to the same thing, which is staying up and staying in the division.
And it's funny, looking ahead to the Brentford game, how much greater your confidence is having won a game this week. Like, you know, you can take that fixture on a standalone basis. And now we've got a little bit of wind in our sails. You think, oh, that's fine coming up that one now. We're not too worried about it.
And Bielsa said afterwards that it was a necessary win. And I thought that was a great way of describing it, because there does come a point where the form has been poor or mediocre for so long that it starts to set in. And despite what even the best coaches try to do, it's very difficult to transmit confidence to players who feel like they've been out of form for a long time and feel like it isn't happening. It was obviously necessary because the league table was not looking great and it had been a poor performance, I felt, down at Palace. But also, you'd had over the weekend the saga of Phillips v Bielsa, which didn't really exist but turned into something anyway. And that does tend to happen more and more when you're out of form or when you're struggling or when people perceive that you're struggling and assume that there might be things that are not right behind the scenes. And I kind of felt on Tuesday it was just a way of kind of washing a lot of that away, of cleansing what had been a pretty difficult weekend for everybody. And also the nature of the goal, the way it came and the time it came is good for people. It is good for people. And I don't doubt that the players will be in a great frame of mind this weekend.
It was something of a palate cleanser, wasn't it, that goal? It just reset the whole narrative around the place and the feeling around the place. Because everyone came out of that absolutely buzzing. The atmosphere outside the stadium, I mentioned over on our show, you could hear people singing when you were a good, you know, quarter of a mile away from the ground. You could hear them singing the far side of the ground.
For all that we've slated VAR, that was definitely a penalty. It was 100% a penalty. Yeah. And we've got this situation now where whenever there's a VAR decision, because you don't get any video replays inside the ground for the crowd from the big screen, we get them on the TVs that we've got in the press box. Everybody in front of us in the press box turns around and looks at us and basically says, is this a penalty? And I was saying to people, I'm pretty sure this is going to be, because his arm's above his head.
You're like a Roman emperor with the thumb out, with it thumb up, thumb down.
Do you know what? That's exactly how we should start playing this game. Mm. Yeah. And clearly, like during the game, you know, if it's middle of the first half and there's a penalty appeal, it matters, but it's not the same. There's not the same amount riding on it. But in those circumstances, I was looking down at the crowd and everybody was just staring at us, basically saying, what is going on? And of course, he goes to the screen. And as soon as he goes to the screen, he's going to give it. And it was a great bit of theatre. And for all that I have been critical of VAR, and I still don't really like certain aspects of it, even though I think this season we're starting to acclimatise to it more, and I do think it's starting to work better, it was just a great moment and it teed everything up for that penalty. And there is a difference, I think, between a 1-0 win where you score early on and then you slog through to the end, and by the end of the game, people are kind of sick of it, and a game where it's been in the balance and you win it like that. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm still undecided as to who deserved what from that game on Tuesday. It was very hard to tell at the end because Leeds had more of it and I think were the team who were trying to win it or you know, team who were trying to play. But Palace's tactics were not bad for them. They worked to their strengths. And Benteke had that absolute sitter. I mean, when he came off the bench, we said to each other, he is guaranteed to get a header from about 6 yards out at some stage. And it was almost the trademark goal that Leeds always concede when they're not playing well, which is that somebody just appears 6 yards out, totally unmarked, bang, and the crowd just lose it. And him missing that actually reminded me a little bit of, if you remember the Gary Monk game against Blackburn, circumstances were totally different. I mean, it felt that night like Monk was right on the verge of the sack. But there was that save from Rob Green at 1-1 that dug that shot out of the top corner somehow. And Kyle Bartley went on to win the game late on. And it was that sort of topsy-turvy moment where you felt like it was balanced and things were going to fall one way or the other. And of course, there was that Melier save as well. And I think to come through that and then to win it late on with a penalty from the only player who should have been taking it. I mean, if anybody else on the pitch had been taking that, I'd have been thinking, not sure about this. But, you know, I was pleased that it was Rafinha who grabbed the ball and took it. To win like that is a big shot in the arm.
Balls like watermelons.
And also just tailor-made for that sort of situation. He's that kind of big game, big moment player.
Yeah. He would have loved that moment, wouldn't he?
Of course he would. And you could tell that he loved it. You know, you could
probably
tell
the only person in the ground.
Yeah. I don't think anybody else would have been rushing to have taken that. If Bamford had been on the pitch, he might have asked for it. But it just made sense. Your form player, the only player who's really played well from start to finish this season, give him the ball, let him do it. That run-up was horrendous.
one of the things we've touched on when we did the match ball, like in the wake of this, was said, it's one of those moments where so much races through your mind in just a split second, and you can't articulate exactly what it is that you were thinking, because it's just terror, it's joy, it's excitement, whatever it might be. What went through your mind during that second? Because I remember seeing him do the skip and thought, what's he doing? But then by the time I'd processed it, it was in the net.
Short run-ups and, you know, stunted run-ups give you the jitters. And I don't know if there's any science behind this, but I always feel that when you have a run-up like that, you're more likely to miss. And I think it's fair to say that it did put the keeper in two minds, didn't know whether to go right or left. It was not a long way away from him. It was not a great penalty in the sense of where the finish was placed. And I think if the keeper gets a bit more spring to the left, then he does save that. So yeah, tension. But I was watching one of the videos back when I got home on Tuesday night, and there's that wonderful just sliver of silence as he's about to hit the ball.
It's the intake of air, isn't it?
Quiet, which is what Beckford always talks about when you ask him about that goal he scored to win promotion back in 2010. He says, the thing I always hear when I come in the ground is just that moment of silence as I was about to hit the ball, because everybody knows it's going in. Everybody knows it's going in. Everybody knows it should be a goal and it's going to be a goal. But for, you know, split second, you just don't want to count your chickens.
It was that same split second of silence that you got before Melier clawed it off the line, and everyone realised Benteke's header had gone wide as well, because, I mean, I'm at the far end of the ground and everyone just went, oh. It was a double take of, I can't believe he's not put that in.
Unbelievable, that, wasn't it? And I don't think we mentioned it on our shows because we hadn't spotted it at the time, but Benteke's running away to celebrate.
He is. You can see from the camera behind the goal that you don't get enough of it to actually see him celebrating, but he's moving in the speed which thinks, right, to the away end now. And the amazing thing about that save is not just that Millie reaches back to get hold of it, but that he basically pivots his entire body back, you know, turns around with the ball behind him so he can actually see it, and then has that Spider-Man reach that just lets him take it.
And doesn't get it first time.
No, it bubbles around. So
unbelievable.
Sometimes if he looks in, it's in. But I think it's probably fair to say that the goal that Melier stopped would have done more damage, I think, to the atmosphere, because it was a mess. You know, that it was, Cooper misjudged the ball, it comes off Benteke's toe, but Benteke doesn't really catch it cleanly, and then Melier's got his back to it and is scrambling backwards. If that goes in, I think that would have done far more damage to the atmosphere than Benteke's header. I think Benteke's header would have flattened everything, but you would still have said it's a very conventional goal. It's Saha crossing, it's Benteke heading in at the back post. The Melier one was really that kind of moment where it just feels like, you know, it feels like the seams are coming apart.
It's funny how games turn on moments, isn't it? And I think one thing I experienced with the Palace game is that every time we had a little moment of adversity, like defending our own goal, the crowd lifted again as a result of it. Like, so it felt like a positive thing for us that we could like harness and try and channel going forward then when Melier made that save.
Also, when you're not playing particularly well, and I still don't feel that Leeds are. I mean, if just to touch on Brighton for a moment, I feel like that's probably one of the few times, perhaps the only time, where I've looked at Bielsa and thought, I don't think you know what to do with this team. You know, just in those 90 minutes and in that game, I don't think you know what to do here, because it was Phillips at centre-back, it was Phillips to centre-mid, it was Dallas in midfield, it was Dallas to right-back, it was Llorente at right-back and then into the middle, it was James on the left and then on the right and having started up front. And it did just feel massively, massively confused. And there was a little bit of that on Tuesday, because obviously there were three changes to the starting lineup. There were two changes at half-time with Rodrigo coming on and Firpo. So again, it isn't totally settled. But I think that result will allow Bielsa to get his head around a few things as well. And I think with Ayling and Bamford coming back now, you do feel like you might potentially have far more of a steadier team and a steadier lineup for a period of weeks, not wanting to tempt fate because injuries never seem too far away. But the point I was going to make was that when you're out of form, even little things like Dan James pressing and making two blocks in the space of about 3 seconds, and then Roberts following it up with another block, you know, the crowd like that and the crowd get into that. And I think what that did on Tuesday, without it being a stellar performance, was it meant that it never felt like Leeds had faded out of the game, and you always felt like they were in it and they were still grafting. And even in the patches where Palace started to look threatening on the counter, you did still think that a goal could quite easily come at either end. And I definitely felt there was a goal in it. It just didn't seem like that was going to finish goalless on Tuesday.
Do you think people are warming to Dan James now?
I think they should be after that in the second half. Forgetting for a moment about the pressing and so on, which he can be very good at, and his pace and so on, there was a bit more end product, I thought, on Tuesday, particularly the chance for Rodrigo. Rodrigo seemed to get caught in two minds as to whether to take a touch and finish, and in the end it was a sort of bundled shot that was kind of as much...
Just
as,
almost bounced off him, didn't
it? Yeah, it wasn't really anything. But that made me think of the much better times under Bielsa, when the one thing Leeds were very good at was creating chances. And I mean, that was a ridiculous chance, really. That crossfield volley from Rafinha that covered about 50 yards. And then James just doing the right thing, ball down, bit of pace, into the middle to Rodrigo. And Rodrigo misses, but Leeds consistently through Bielsa's time have always had a fairly poor finishing rate on, or have not made it as easy as they could have done with the chances they've created. But crucially, the chances were there. And I think that's been one of the stories of this season, is that too often the chances haven't been there in the first place. And you're never going to score if they aren't. And yeah, I think people should warm to James. I think you saw more of him, more of what he can do as a creative outlet in that game than we have previously. And I've said this more than once. I don't think the time at Man United will have been good for him. And I do think that Dan James coached will be a better player than Dan James, who just seemed to be in the mix at Old Trafford and no more than that.
He looks a lot more confident and settled, like he knows what the game plan is. And I think it helps having him on the left-hand side. You know, you're talking about the Brighton game where you thought maybe Bielsa didn't quite know what to do with it. Pal of mine, Wayne, texted me around the Brighton game and he said, I don't understand a significant percentage of recent lineups. And again, I wonder if they're more down to neuroses than necessity. You know, like he almost feels hell-bent on making a particular plan work, like Dan James up front. He kind of almost trying to sledgehammer it into working, if you like, when actually what we did against Palace was to put the obvious lineup out, all the round pegs in the round holes, and it worked a lot better.
I don't think the past couple of months have said anything other than you need a centre-forward in the centre-forward's position, and that will be Bamford before long. But I agree with that. I do think there's merit in a coach who tries to stick with something as opposed to doing it, abandoning it, trying something else, mixing about all the time. One of the points I'd make about Brighton was that Phillips at centre-back made sense at Spurs because of the sheer lack of players. You know, something different had to be done. I didn't think that it needed to be done at Brighton because there was an ample supply of centre-backs, and you do look at the team and think, this seems to be that old thing of square pegs in round holes or the other way around for no obvious reason particularly. And what I think concerned me at Brighton was that when Phillips moved forward and moved back into that defensive midfield role, and you thought to yourself, well, this is Leeds setting the formation that they know inside out, 4-1-4-1, it suddenly looked and felt really unfamiliar. Didn't look like they were comfortable with it. And you just had that concern that even the real basics of what they do were starting to get a bit flimsy. And you wondered if that was because of the chopping and changing. But I did feel against Palace that it was far more rigid. I thought Forshaw had a massive game against Palace. He's been really good since he's come back. Covers so much ground and does an awful lot of graft. I think there's always the danger that a last minute goal can make you romanticise about what's gone on in the previous 90 minutes. And I think there were fair stretches of that game against Palace where I was aware of the crowd around us getting pretty sick of how it was and struggling to enjoy some of the football. But they were better, no doubt about it.
I say, I look at that lineup from the Palace game, and while there were, you know, moments like Firpo, for example, 2 minutes in.
Yes.
In the second half, you know, off the back of what had happened at Brighton, you know, oh God, this could all fall apart based on that. But apart from some individual moments, and like, you know, Cooper had let the odd one through for that Benteke chance, I don't think anybody had a bad game overall. As you look at it, they were all at least 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10.
I don't think Firpo had a bad game either.
No,
he came into it, and it's only fair to say that in the same way as it's only fair to say that Roberts did make a difference at Brighton. I don't think Roberts was terrible against Palace. plenty of effort, but I think again I'm left thinking that there's a better option there without a doubt, and I still don't really know where this is going for Roberts longer term. But no, they did dig in, and I mean let's be honest, when you're under this sort of pressure and the results are as they are, it's very difficult to click your fingers and get a sparkling performance from nowhere. I think we're potentially far more likely to see it on Sunday against Brentford because they've got this behind them, and because they will feel now that there is this bit of momentum suddenly that they've been crying out for. And also, if you have a squad that has Ailing back in it and Bamford back in it, I know from speaking to players, you know, over many, many years, you sit in a dressing room and you have them with you, and you automatically feel like you're far closer to Full Metal Jacket than you were at Spurs, where it was just basically any man with boots plus Archie Gray at 15, you know, that reached that level of bare bones. But it's different now. And Ailing and Bamford both came through the 23s fine on Monday night. Bamford did 90 minutes. I'd be really, really surprised if they're not involved Sunday.
So it does feel like a happier, more relaxed place. And if it does all go belly up this year and we do get relegated, shut the whole thing down and we'll just dig up our new expensive Elland Road pitch and turn it over to collective agriculture, because that seems to be one of the topics that made it onto the tip of the tongue for the Palace game.
Yes. Are we on to Kinnear's programme notes?
Yeah.
Yes. So there are two ways to look at this. The first is that sort of reference is weird and bizarre and not helpful. And I think these days as well, irrespective of what you mean by writing that, people are automatically, and actually I think quite rightly, going to look at it and say, look, that's over the top and there's no need for that comparison. And it doesn't make an awful lot of sense when you're talking about an independent regulator for the game. My personal view on this is the opposite to Kinnear's, which is that I can see potentially the merit of an independent regulator. But there were things in that column that I did actually agree with. The first is to say that if the independent regulator is a government structure, then there's a very high likelihood that it'll be a shambles and a waste of time, because that is quite often how it goes when the government get involved. I don't think that's the reason why you shouldn't consider having one, but it's something to think about. I think he was right as well to say that if you give more money to clubs further down the pyramid, they will simply spend more money. And you can find examples of periods in the past. Somebody mentioned ITV Digital to me, and that's a good example of clubs getting a huge amount more cash, and the first thing they do is spend it rather than saving it, or rather than trying to use it to protect longer term well-being. And, you know, that has to be considered. I also think it's kind of, there is this perception that in the Premier League, your owners and boards and everything are kind of sharks, and outside the Premier League, it's a kind of picture of good ethics and good morals. I mean, that's clearly not the case. You do get really bad owners down in the EFL as well. But ultimately, I just think that there is a lot of self-interest in football. And as a few other people have said, when you have CEOs in the Premier League, there was Kinnear, there's been Karen Brady, there's been Steve Parrish down at Crystal Palace as well. When you have them collectively en masse fighting it like this, given the Premier League's track record, part of you sort of thinks maybe it is a good idea.
Apologies if I'm repeating myself, because I did mention this over on our show this week, but let's not forget this was a fan-led review, and you know the fans groups don't always get it right, but there is obviously a level of mistrust in the general sense between fans and football administrators.
Yes.
And they don't have good faith in the fact that, well, look at the number of clubs that have gone under or have struggled, you know. Look at what's happening at Derby, for example. They're an absolute shambles because they were chasing the Premier League. And it comes back to the disparity between Premier League and Championship, doesn't it? And 3 years ago, Radrazzani was advocating for a Premier League 2, a breakaway league, mm-hmm. because they wanted a bigger slice of the pie because it wasn't fair.
The pie wasn't theirs to eat, basically.
They wanted to redistribute the wealth 3 years ago. So, you know, let's not pretend that self-interest isn't a massive part of it.
Of course it isn't. And that's why I thought in the Crouch review, there were a lot of really good suggestions in it and a lot of really good ideas. And I would like to think that Leeds and other clubs will take them up, or at least some of them. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I don't think there's any doubt that when a club's in the Premier League, it thinks very differently about how wealth should be distributed to the way that it does when the club's down in the Championship. And as you say, we've seen that with Radrazzani's comments previously. And there is a big problem with things like parachute payments. I mean, I look at Fulham in the Championship at the moment and find it very hard to draw any other conclusion than they are just financially set to dominate that league in a way that nobody else is. And in no small part because, yes, they'll come down with heavy overheads, but equally they're coming down with income from the Premier League that is vastly, vastly higher than what you can get in the Championship. So the structure of the game is messy. I think it does need some more regulation. I don't think you can realistically trust the Premier League to consistently do right by the game, because there is so much self-interest in there. I think the one thing I would say is that clubs too often, in my view, focus on their own support and focus on delivering for their own supporters and everything else. And that is important, but the game doesn't exist without other clubs and other groups of supporters. That is the whole point of it. And there does need to be a bit more of a kind of collective approach to how you try and nurture the game and look after it. I wonder as well whether clubs are serious enough about what they have to do to kind of harness the next generation as well. I do think there's a bit of an assumption with football that people are always going to be interested in the game because it is so wildly popular and because people seem to throw so much money at it. But I don't think you should ever be complacent about the possibility that the next generation or the generation after might find something else to do or find something better to do.
I often think of this when we talk about stadium redevelopment, that at the moment it seems to make perfect sense to make a big stadium, put loads of corporate hospitality in. But you kind of look at a future in which we kind of regress to like how football was in the 80s, and you look at Spurs with their massive ground, you think what an absolute disaster of a complete pit of debt that place would be if all of a sudden businesses aren't interested in spending 500 quid a ticket to go and, you know, to go and watch a Premier League game. So, and again, as we were talking about on our show, at the point at which that falls apart, there will be a core of 10,000, 20,000, 2,000 at lower, some of the clubs in League One or whatever, who will go, right, well, okay, we'll sort this out and we want to keep a team in Bury or Macclesfield or wherever.
Or Chester or whatever, yeah.
And it does fall to those people, and the people who have essentially caused the problems in the first place are long gone, aren't they? Mm. And it's no point them saying, well, we don't want, it was better without regulation, because that is not their problem, is it? Essentially, no. They don't have to tidy up the mess from it. I think Angus Kinnear is in a fairly safe position at the moment with this, because Leeds fans are generally fairly pleased, I think, with the way the club is run. There's not any, so I guess maybe, I don't know if he's misjudged it slightly in thinking that everyone will go, oh yeah, you're right, what you're doing is great, so just keep doing it, and we don't want to change anything. I don't know if he's maybe underestimated the memories of some people and of how bad it has been in the very recent past.
Yeah. He likes a one-liner, does Kinnear, but I thought the tone of it was probably too jovial for what is a pretty serious subject. I mean, I think he was trying to make serious points, but it does come back to that thing of the ownership at Leeds have obviously not set the rules for football, and football is as it is now, which basically means that if you want to run a club, you need to pile loads of cash into it, or you need to get other people to pile loads of cash into it via sponsorship or whatever else. And that's why I think we will, you know, see the transition from Radrazzani to the 49ers, because it will take somebody like the 49ers or 49ers Enterprises to push the club on and to find that sort of income. So given that you're in that environment, what can you do apart from play the game and kind of go with it? But as I say, I think the Premier League saying to you, honestly, we don't need to be regulated, we're fine, is something that people should be very, very sceptical of.
Is there a weird level of interest in regulating football? Given it's, I know it is big business, but it's not big business compared to Apple, for example. In terms of relative to, you know, the sort of multinational corporations, it's still fairly small amounts of money, and it feels like a lot of pressure is often put on football in one way or another, as in like, well, you've got this money, you can spread some of that about.
Well, this goes back though to, you know, the Disney Ultras and Moana Away and all that we spoke about. In that Apple are just a corporate
Starbucks versus player. Costa.
Yeah, Apple just a corporate product.
Kicking lumps out of each other behind the station.
There's the community aspect of football, which seems to become smaller and smaller and smaller in the minds of people who run clubs generally. I'm not really talking about Leeds. I think Leeds are pretty active in the community and understand the city. But it doesn't feel like your biggest owners are. And actually, I mean, I guess to be fair to like Manchester City, for example, they have invested massively around the stadium. So perhaps that isn't totally fair, but there is the community aspect to it. And because of that, it's a completely different consideration to Apple. And I think what you would say is that if Apple went out of business, obviously people would lose jobs and there'd be livelihoods at stake and all that sort of thing. But from a community point of view, people would just buy other mobile phones, wouldn't they, and other laptops. But if Leeds United went out of business, or if clubs disappeared or whatever else, what do you replace them with?
I'd probably have a much more peaceful life.
you'd live longer and I'd have had hair for longer. But no. You don't just go down the road and support Huddersfield, do you? That's not how it is, and that's not how it works. And football clubs can make a big difference to the community in a way that I don't think you can feel Apple or big corporations doing. However much sort of charitable work they do, you don't see Apple going into schools in Leeds to talk about knife violence or, you know, social issues or anything like that to do that sort of close to home community work. So it is totally different. I don't think clubs like the idea of a regulator or not the biggest ones because it potentially constrains what they can do. But as I say, that's not a reason not to have one.
Yeah, and just to add some balance from a Leeds United perspective is they are listening. They don't always get it right, but at least they're listening and will consult with fans and say, if we didn't get it right, tell us why.
To be fair to Kinnear as well, in my experience of him, I think he'll understand totally that people are going to disagree with those notes. I think he would probably fight the corner, his corner over the reference to the Maoist regime and famines and so on. Although, like I say, I think with hindsight, if you don't put that in, you don't have flak coming back at you. But I think he would understand that not everybody's going to look at that and say, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, people will argue the toss and quite rightly. But as ever with, you know, these sort of things and these reviews, ultimately, what is it going to lead to? I think that's the question. You know, is it going to be more than words on paper? And is it going to change the game?
It feels like often with these things, the conclusion is that there's some balance put in there and they'll allow Premier League clubs to appoint their own regulator or something. Or they'll sign up to some extra degree of regulation, which will be a bit of a paper tiger because it'll be kind of, well, we've put this person in charge who we know is going to not actually do too much to damage our businesses.
Come in, Richard Scudamore.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, happy birthday, Calvin Phillips. 26 years old today, entering the peak of his career. Good player, isn't he?
Does that make you feel old, him being 26? I was thinking about this because quite often I look at the age of players, you know, like these days, Johnny Howson and so on. You think Howson's ticking on now, and you can remember him coming through and you think it really is that long ago since I was that sort of age. But Phillips at 26, he feels like he's been around for ages. But yeah, 26, that make you feel old?
A little bit, yeah. We've ticked past that point now where I've seen players like start their careers and finish their careers. You know, I think of players like Harry Kewell, and now you're looking at, you know, other ones who are just about to finish. James Milner, who's probably going to finish at some point in the next two or three. I mean, like, he's still a teenager in my mind. But then again, so am I.
I think Archie Gray's the one for me. When I saw him in the Arsenal squad the other day, I thought, I genuinely could be his dad, like, without, it wouldn't have even been a controversial pregnancy. That I'd have been, you know, I'd have been a perfectly acceptable age.
Well, the day Paddy Kenny left Leeds, I think, was the last time that I had a player at Leeds who was older than me. And I suppose the next step for that will be the first time you have a player in the squad who is younger than one of your kids, that you know that it's reached that point, really, hasn't
well,
it?
I'll tell you what, this has got into old men shouting at cloud here.
Yes.
So let's talk about Calvin Phillips. It's also David Batty's birthday as well. Again, he can't be 53. That doesn't feel right to me. But anyway,
he was always 53 in a way, though, was David Batty, I think. He always had a middle-aged sort of personality about him, didn't he?
Calvin Phillips has been the breakout star for England this year. I mean, what a 12 months he's had. It's been phenomenal for him, hasn't it? It's just been great. He's England's player of the year, mainstay in that midfield. England looks so much better when he's in there. Southgate was there on Tuesday when Leeds played Palace, and no doubt another tick in the box.
Yeah, it seems to me that for all that, opinion is very, very much divided on Southgate, and there seem to be a lot of people who don't think he's actually doing great things with the England squad, or perhaps, to be fair, is not making the sum of the parts collectively as high as it should be given the players that he's got. I think his new contract with the FA is, there's probably nobody who'll be more pleased with that news than Phillips, because he is very much one of the boys under Southgate and right in the mix, and really has been since the start. I always got the impression that Southgate had kind of set this rule that players in the Championship weren't really going to get into his squad. It was more, there were a couple of exceptions, like when Mason Mount was at Derby, but it was, you know, it was going to be Premier League players predominantly who were in there. And I always felt that he was kind of swaying with Phillips because Phillips was playing so well for Bielsa that he wanted to bring him into the fold, but he was just waiting for the right time. But Phillips has done what Rafinha looks like doing with Brazil, which is walked into the squad straight away, start games and become a fixture overnight. It's not an easy thing to do that. And you've seen that with Bamford, you know, the one game against Andorra and the one call up, and okay, has had injuries since. But I think for him, it'll be far more difficult to force his way into that position. Whereas with Phillips, you've got Southgate there watching him on Tuesday, and perhaps not just him, but, you know, certainly there with Phillips in front of him. And you just know that if he's fit and still in reasonable form, that when Qatar comes round, he is 100% going to be one of the 23 that goes. And that's been, you know, that's been one of two stages in his development, the first club-wise under Bielsa, which has been monumental. But again, as an international player, you can tell that the England players playing with him are perfectly happy to have him in the team.
And one of the nice things that came out of the game on Tuesday against Palace was putting to bed this idea of any sort of rift with Bielsa, which is a media narrative that had sprung up because, well, why? Let's examine the reasons why. But he said he'll play goalkeeper if he asks him, and he's got so much respect for Bielsa because he's taken him from being a middling championship midfielder to the first name on the England team sheet.
Perhaps the one thing we need before Bielsa leaves is an outfield player in goal. Just for the banter, you know, if he's going in the summer, he decides he's going in the summer and we've got one game left at the end of the season against Brentford or something like that. Phillips goes in goal.
He wouldn't disrespect the opponents.
No, he wouldn't. He'd still try and win 5-0, but just for fun. There's a weird, I think, modern trend, which has been developing more and more and more, of pundit says X, pundit's comments are put to manager, manager has a pop at pundit, everybody writes about it, and I'm sure I've done that from time to time too. And you do find that sometimes this narrative, like, you know, Bielsa and Phillips are banging heads, is created from a pretty innocuous throwaway discussion in a Sky studio after or during the Brighton game on Saturday, where I think it's fair to say there was frustration and there was confusion and there was no doubt about that. It was not a good performance. And I think you could see in Phillips' body language that he was thinking, centre back, I'm now back in midfield, it's not quite working. But a lot of ways to go with this. The first is to say that him being substituted early is by no means a new phenomenon with Bielsa. And actually, as Bielsa's proved pretty comprehensively, you don't get any sacred cows at Leeds. There is literally nobody that Bielsa is scared of upsetting by saying, you're coming off after 20 minutes or at half time. I'm not saying he necessarily feels good about doing it. And he has apologised a few times after the games where it's occurred for him having to do it. But you had Phillips substituted, you know, in the first half of his 100th club appearance at Swansea. You had him substituted at halftime at Old Trafford. You know, the last season, the game that Phillips has spent all week saying to the players, you need to know how big this is. You know, his first chance to play for Leeds against Man United. And, you know, it's an absolute washout for him. So on that basis alone, Phillips coming off, I don't think had any significance to it. The other thing is that we know what a fallout with Bielsa looks like. It looks like Janssen getting sold to Brentford with no other offers on the table, but the club told, I want you to sell him, and basically you're going to have to take that offer because that's what is there. And Janssen's gone. Hernandez, you know, the black armband incident, and he did kind of come back into the fold. It's slightly different with Hernandez because he did seem to be fading out of the picture somewhat anyway, but was then basically on the bench in league games for the next 4 or 5 months before the final appearance against West Brom. That's what happens when you fall out with Bielsa. What doesn't happen is that you go back into the starting lineup on Tuesday and you smash Conor Gallagher after 6 minutes and you play like Phillips played. And it seemed quite obvious to me, looking at what was going on, that the talk of a clash between them just wasn't there, really. It was making something of something that didn't really seem to exist. And I don't think, as I say, we should pretend that this season will have been good for people and that everybody in the background at Leeds will be sitting saying, oh, isn't this fun? Because it's not fun when you're playing poorly and when you're struggling for results. But it did just seem like a kind of monumental leap, and something that actually, when we asked Bielsa about it on Monday, he seemed totally nonplussed about.
And the Premier League is a TV programme, let's not forget. You know, it makes all its money through being a TV programme, predominantly overseas and in this country as well. And it needs to have like narrative attached to it, doesn't it? It needs to have storylines. I mean, a friend of mine who lives in the Middle East says that's how it's almost billed, you know, like on Middle Eastern TV. It'll be around manager clashes with manager, this player clashes with this player. It's not the same as we like consume it as fans, and we're so emotionally attached to the idea of our manager, Bielsa, you know, he's a sacred cow, so is Phillips. And the idea of the two of them falling out is just, it's horrible, isn't it?
I think that's the way, it's why England's Calvin Phillips falling out with Bielsa is, you know, that's the storyline. If Pascal Strauch is getting moved around the pitch and doing a post-match interview, no one cares, because outside of Leeds fans, people, he's not someone that people fully know about yet, and it doesn't generate any discussion. Jamie Redknapp probably doesn't know who he is. He doesn't really seem to know where Calvin Phillips plays a lot of the time either, to be perfectly honest.
Whereas Michael Owen would have watched him come up through the you know, the Leeds junior teams.
You're like, saw
him play when, saw him play when he was like 15 and 10 and all the rest of it. Sorry, go on. I derailed you.
That's fine. But I think it's just the frustration of knowing that that is why it's being talked about. It's not that there's anything necessarily there. It's just, well, people know Calvin Phillips, and it's something people will be interested in.
From seeing what happened with Hernandez and Janssen, you know that it could happen. You know, it's not out of the, beyond the realms of possibility that that could happen. But I think if you're going to say that, you have to be pretty sure that that is the case. It's a bit brash to kind of float that without any substance to it. I thought as well, there was a big contrast between the Crystal Palace game where Hernandez was left out after him throwing the black armband away, and us pressing Bielsa on that, and Bielsa basically saying, I've said what I said, I do not want to say any more on this. And giving you the impression that yes, there is an issue, and yes, there is a problem, but I'm not going to do this in public, and you know, I've said what I've said, and that's the end of it. Whereas with Phillips, when he was asked, you know, about you might have fallen out with him, his first reply was to say, you're going to need to explain that a bit more to me, because I don't know what you mean. And actually, but somebody on Twitter swears blind to me, and they did have a photo of Bielsa and Costa, and they said to me that yesterday, I think, and this is Wednesday of this week, Bielsa was in Costa reading articles about him and Calvin Phillips, and at the end of every one he ripped them in half and put them in the bin. So he seemed kind of surprised by it, to be asked that, and did really just say there's no problem with anybody, you know. And also, if you're telling me that Phillips can never be subbed, then I'm telling you, you're absolutely wrong. And on that point, he's right, and Phillips knows the drill. I mean, Phillips has seen that before, and to get a performance like that, on, you know, commitment like that, I didn't think Phillips actually played especially well on Tuesday. I thought Forshaw had by far the better game of the two. But you only had to look at it, even prior to Phillips' post-match comments, where he kind of said, I'll play in goal if I have to. You looked at it and you thought, there's nothing going on.
And it was Joe Catling who tweeted you that, because I've just gone in and found it, the retweet that you did. And we do know, don't we, that Bielsa has all the articles that are written about him translated, and he reads everything.
A huge number of them, yes.
So you have to behave yourself, Phil Hay, because if he suddenly walks out one day, I'll be going through your articles to make sure you've been nice about Marcelo Bielsa. Just going back to Jamie Redknapp, I do wonder if Jamie Redknapp has thought, I wouldn't like it if that was happening to me, if I was being told to go back into central defence, and therefore Calvin Phillips doesn't like it either.
Perhaps. The one thing that did obviously pop up was the interview that Phillips did at Spurs, where he did sound like he wasn't quite sure what was going on, and he was saying himself there were times in the second half where we should have gone long. You know, there was that conflict between him saying, I don't know why Bielsa put me where he put me, but then explained why he had, because they'd obviously worked on it through the week. And if I'm, you know, being charitable to Phillips, I think maybe what he was meaning was, if you want to understand why I was in the centre of defence, you probably need to ask him. You know, it's his decision and it's his call.
And let's not forget, he was brilliant when he marked Harry Kane.
He did really well. He did. But if you wanted to like micro-analyse the interview, the pauses in it and some of the comments in it, it was all just a bit weird.
Yeah. We've got the Sky Sports linguistic expert in to tell us what this means.
You know, it wasn't that sort of really, really sort of full of conviction confidence that you quite often get from Phillips. But I don't think many of us dwelt on it particularly. And I don't think many of us looked at it and thought, that's really, really odd. It was kind of weird, but it wasn't that big a deal. And you might be right. It might well be that for somebody like Redknapp, he looks at that and thinks, if I was getting played as a midfielder, I was getting played at centre-back, I wouldn't be happy. The point is that Phillips is a totally different midfielder to Redknapp, not even remotely comparable in the way that they play, the way that what they do, and also the way that they've been trained. You know, Phillips has been trained to be an auxiliary centre-back and to drop in between the two central defenders when he has to, when Leeds are in possession. It's not an especially new thing. I just think on Saturday at Brighton, it really didn't work particularly well. And it did look messy, no question about that. But that's not the same as saying that the two of them are kicking lumps out of each other at Thorpe Arch.
Well, the other subtext that kind of underpins all this is that he's an England international now. He's too good for Leeds. He'll be leaving. And I think that's what it's feeding into, that whole sort of storyline, isn't it?
It's also the Premier League, which is what I was saying about, you know, pundit says this, manager. You see it a lot with Jurgen Klopp and Gary Neville as one example. You know, Gary Neville said this, and, you know, Klopp can get quite frustrated about some of the things that are said. So we'll give very quotable quotes in return, and it makes a fight over something which sometimes you think is not a waste of everybody's energy. This Klopp, just to veer off on a tangent for a second, this seemed kind of very angry to me this season, despite how well the team are playing. And you might remember him having a pop at a Spanish journalist after the Atletico Madrid game, where Simeone didn't shake his hand at full time. And that, I think, goes back to what you were saying about, you know, Premier League narrative, managers falling out, players falling out with managers. Well, Klopp got to the point after the game of saying, he didn't shake my hand, I didn't shake his hand, but you know what, I don't care, and I can't be bothered speaking about this, and I don't want to speak about this, and end of story, really. And, you know, I think there was a degree of that over the weekend, of just looking at the Phillips thing. I mean, I spoke to people and said, is there anything, any issue here? Not at all, you know, not really. Which is not to say that Phillips would have enjoyed the Brighton game or would have felt like the system was working or the performance going well. I think all the players would have come off happy with the point, but pretty disappointed with the way they'd played. But that's not the same as having a kind of bona fide rift with your manager.
In terms of him staying or maybe going at some point further down the line, I was greatly encouraged when we spoke to Hayden Evans in here the other week about him saying, like, you know, Calvin's got really strong feelings and you know, dropped the L-bomb, loyalty to Leeds as a club. So where are we in terms of him staying? And the contract has kind of been mooted. It's kind of been spoken about sort of quietly, hasn't it? Are we any further along with that?
I don't think so. I don't think that's really made any progress. Although I wouldn't have said that either side, him or the club, felt an urgent rush to get it done. But there does seem to be commitment on Phillips' side to speak about it, commitment on Leeds' side to renegotiate and to pay more and to understand that because he is an England international now and because he is one of the pick of the players at Elland Road, he should be earning more and should be closer to the sort of wage that an England international would earn. But no, I don't think at this stage there's been much in the way of progress with it.
He's on sort of mid-level wages, isn't he, for the squad or thereabouts?
He's on pretty good money, you know, yeah. He is. It's not a poor wage, but everything becomes relative. And it's not just that he's kind of around the England squad, he's in it and he's in the team. And he is a high-value player. I mean, I always remember speaking to Robert Snodgrass about this after he left Leeds, and he would say from time to time, Leeds would say to him things like, we think of you as a £8 million player or a £10 million player. You know, if we were ever to sell you, particularly in the periods where Snodgrass was starting to get a bit fed up with how, you know, how things were going at Leeds and this kind of lack of ambition, they would say that to him, you know, we think that's what you'd be valued at. And he said, you know, part of me was thinking, well, in that case, pay me the wage of a £10 million player. Oh no, we don't want to do that. No, well, you see, that is the middle ground that you have to find, is that you can't spend more than you can afford to spend, but equally, you can't hang on to assets of high value and of high worth if you don't pay them what they're worth. And as I say, you can tell by speaking to Leeds that they totally understand that with Phillips.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So we are recording this on Thursday ahead of the Brentford game at Spurs, but we can go above them if things work out for us at the weekend, Phil, when we play on Sunday. And 2 extra days rest for Leeds, do you think that'll be significant?
Could be, although managers and squads and clubs tend to be pretty good, especially at the top level, of managing bodies and physique through these periods. I don't really know what to expect from Brentford. A result they really needed against Everton last weekend, but Everton look like that sort of team that everybody's going to get a result against at the moment.
Bottom of the form table, aren't they, at the minute?
Well, do you know what was funny on Wednesday? I sat and watched the Merseyside derby, and I thought to myself, you know, I spent a lot of this season thinking, you're watching Leeds and thinking, is this okay? Are they in trouble? Where is this going? Quite hard to be sure. You've got your gut feeling, and my gut feeling has always been that, yeah, they will be okay. But there are patches of games where it just doesn't feel good. And then I watched Everton on Wednesday night, and I thought they look like relegation fodder in a far bigger way than Leeds, just purely based on that game. I mean, their results are absolutely dreadful. So Brentford got that win, and it's good. It was good for them because it did feel like after a kind of bust of form and a streak up the table, that they were starting to go into reverse gear and starting to slip down the table. I think they were 16 points from 13 games. I think they'd be pretty happy with that, especially given that it does give them a little bit of a gap to the bottom three. They've got a really good chance of staying up this season. And as we saw in the Championship with them, actually under different managers, because they always tended to have a similar sort of style and stick to it, they're a pretty dangerous team on the day.
They seem to have settled into that sort of middling group of Premier League teams that we are. I think we're just tiptoeing into it now. I think
we were in it last year, certainly.
Yeah, and I think we're sort of just towards the lower reaches of it now. But again, you look at it and you see the performance against Palace, the good bits anyway, and you look at this when you think this is a game we should be giving ourselves every chance of winning.
It's very much of a muchness, the bottom half of the table, with what's looking like with Newcastle in particular, really, really endangered clubs down at that level. But as you pick through the teams, Burnley, Watford, Southampton, Everton, Villa, Palace, Brentford, it's hard to think of Leeds as being significantly worse than any of them, which I think is why there always was the possibility of some pretty rapid salvation this season, and this week might be the one. I mean, I feel that if Leeds go up to 18 points this week and Burnley stick around on 10, albeit, you know, with a game in hand, but it is against Tottenham, who I think will get better under Conte, that's a big gap. And also, considering that you're probably going to need 36 plus to stay up, sometimes it's less than that, but, you know, that would be a decent ballpark figure, I think. You're halfway there with 15 games gone, and that's a pretty good position to be in. And this is the weird thing, really. The comparisons for last season, the points total is not significantly different. I think what you have to accept is that Leeds haven't been playing as well, and have certainly not been as dangerous going forward. They've not created as much. It's there in the stats. It's there in the games. So there is a difference. You know, it's not like this season is the same as last season, but it's absolutely there for them to drag themselves out of this properly and to just restore a bit of proper calm.
I think you're right in what you've said about the top teams stretching away, Chelsea, Man City and Liverpool. I'm just looking at the table. Do you know what the dead giveaway is? It's the goal difference, because you've got Chelsea top with a goal difference of 27, Man City have got 21, Liverpool have got 31. Below that, you've got West Ham with a positive goal difference of 8. Then everybody below that is either 0 in the form of Wolves, who are 6th, and Brentford, who are 11th. Everybody else has a negative goal difference.
It's incredible that, actually. I've never noticed that. But from 5th down,
yeah,
there's nobody with a positive goal difference. And I mean, Liverpool, plus 31 after 14 games, is what you get in Scotland with Rangers and Celtic. You know, that's how it goes up there consistently. And Chelsea and City, I mean, Liverpool have scored 43 goals. 43 goals in 14 games. You kind of average of 3 a game. And it does sort of feel like when you play these teams, you might well be looking at an average of 3 concessions per game.
Which is what we got, which is exactly what we got against
Liverpool.
Because
that is the level that they're kind of on. And you
should we have a rest for a few weeks after Brentford? Just not do a podcast till the new year, maybe?
Yeah, come back in sort of late December and see what's happened.
If you forfeit a game, you forfeit it 3-0, don't you? So we could maybe just give that a go. I don't know. That's the general default score. Just get the pain out of the way in one go.
But you do need to leave them to get on with it at top three. And the odd thing about the arguments over European Super League and so on is that nobody really wants it to happen, because you don't want the domestic league to get decimated. But actually, if this continues and if this carries on, you're starting to get so far adrift from the best teams in the league that sometimes you do almost feel it would maybe be better if you went off and just had your own Champions League that you all just played in. And I've borderline lost interest in the Champions League these days, because it feels like a poker game of high rollers where somebody ends up winning, and whoever ends up winning was always likely to win, because they spent so much money on players and they've got so much in the way of resources that the possibility was always there. But you're right. I mean, to go down through the division, I wonder if there's ever been a season where it's been so apparent that a little group have been this far ahead of the rest.
And you know that Leeds have been struggling to score a little bit. We've looked slightly toothless in attack. And one thing I mentioned, I think it was some weeks ago now, Sporting Intel, Nick Harris, who's on Twitter, has correlated number of goals scored generally equates to the number of points that you get. And if you look at the table, it roughly correlates even now. There are some outliers in there, like Newcastle have scored 16 goals and got 7 points. But
by and large, for every goal you score, you'll get a point. So if we can just up our output, get a few more goals here and there, it should, you know, come the end of the season, even it out, and we should be mid-table comfortably, hopefully.
And also, a point a game keeps you up. I mean, there are virtually no seasons where you actually need 40 points to stay up in the Premier League. And Leeds are on 15 after 14 games. So, you know, they're kind of on track for that. I think it's just the fact the romance has gone out with Leeds a little bit, isn't
it?
It's not exciting
at all, is it?
No, not
that the football's not exciting.
It's what you're kind of aiming for. And it's the first time under Bielsa that you've been thinking a point a game would be quite nice. You know, that's just never been the way. But I think it's fair to expect that every manager is going to need periods like that, because it can't all be astronomical trajectories that just keep taking you up and up and up. They suddenly feel in better shape after the Palace game. And I do think, if we're fair, over recent games, there has been some good football played by Leeds in them. Brighton, not so much, or not at all, really. But there have been patches where it's felt better, and patches where I think I've looked at it and thought, a team playing like that shouldn't be finishing bottom three. If they can play like that and they can piece it together properly, then they will be okay. But we did make the point that this week was so important because of what's coming next. And people always say to me, Bielsa's teams, you know, they tend to do pretty well, or they can do pretty well against the top sides. I think the problem this season is that the top sides have stretched away. Leeds, to a degree, have regressed from, you know, the best of the football they were playing last season. And because of that, it does leave you much more exposed in those fixtures.
It is a league of the sort of non-European competitors, isn't it, that we're in really now. And as we said before, Brentford are in that. What sort of a game are you expecting on Sunday? Are you expecting a little bit more of a spring in the step going into this because of the Palace result?
Yeah, I think we'll get more goals as well. There were chances on Tuesday, but if it had finished goalless, you'd have come away thinking, yeah, I kind of felt that in the waters for a lot of that game. Brentford tend to be pretty ambitious. They do try to win games. They've got Tony up front who does score goals. I think, again, they're a side who are very beatable, but if you give them chances, you're going to get done in without any doubt. So I feel like this is a game Leeds are going to win. I think the week set them up for that. But I think it'll be close. I think we could get something like a 3-2 win this weekend. That sort of game where it's a bit back and forward.
And this 3-5-2 that they play, I see the two that are up front there. I don't like it when we play teams that have got two up front, because it means we start to faff around with our defence.
Yeah, we've been over this, haven't we? And the numbers do show that they are better in 4-1-4-1 Leeds than with three at the back. But you almost might as well park that on the hard shoulder, that discussion, because it's never ever going to change, is it?
This is true.
It's going to be the strategy.
Pontus Janssen, then, you mentioned him at the start of the show about, is he more of a Bielsa player these days? He's back on Sunday. I reckon he's going to get a good reception. Maybe a bit of pantomime booing through the game or whatever, but he'll be applauded, I would say, before and after, assuming he doesn't do anything like daft.
Yeah, I think he should be as well. I mean, the reason for him going was not as straightforward as one thing or the other. There's no point going into this particular game, but obviously Bielsa got a bit tired with him and got a bit tired of the sort of challenges to his authority that were coming from Janssen. But also, there was a feeling that there were centre-backs who could help Leeds evolve, because they played in a slightly different way to Janssen, and they were more comfortable at carrying the ball out, more comfortable on the ball. Janssen, I always thought, was very, very good centre-back and still is, but he was a header of the ball, he was a clear of the ball, he was the big hits. You know, that was the sort of thing that developed that kind of blood and thunder relationship with the crowd. And I still sort of look at that as probably the most ruthless decision Bielsa has ever taken at Leeds, to get rid of Janssen. But it was the right one, and it was the right one because it brought in Ben White, who I think straight away just did have that bit more finesse. And you know, I don't think that's a slight on Janssen. White's just gone for 50 million to Arsenal, but he was a different player. And Leeds won the title, Leeds went up, Janssen won promotion with Brentford, and Brentford got themselves a very good player for about £5 million, which was a concern for the board at the time, because when Bielsa decided that he should go, it was the only offer they had, and the feeling was that it might be quite difficult to replace Janssen for £5 million. Whatever you thought of Janssen, and if you saw, you know, deficiencies in him, he was basically a very good player. You know, he was, and a good centre-back in the Championship, and in losing that, you had to replace him. It's kind of worked out for everybody, hasn't it? It's worked out for everybody. Leeds got Ben White, Leeds got promoted, won the title. Janssen went to Brentford, has had a very, very good time there.
Ah, but
and
is he
has
happy?
Equally gone up. I think he probably is, you know. I think he probably is. I know the initial video that Brentford did was that kind of classic hostage-looking thing.
The chewed biro.
But I think he will be. And I think we used to say, didn't we, in the period when he was here initially, that Leeds were a club who should be in the Premier League, and Janssen looked like a player who should be playing in the Premier League. They've both got what they want. I don't think there'd be any reason to have any particular bad blood over it.
Tactically then, how can we hurt them? Because if they're playing three at the back, I quite like the idea of getting some fast players and skillful players like Dan James and Rafinha in between their wing backs and their centre-halves. Is that a thing that can happen?
Well, I think that's how Leeds always hurt teams, isn't it? You saw it again on Tuesday, that once it got working out wide, particularly with James on the left, there was that bit more threat. I'd love to think that Ayling will come back into this team. I'd love to think that Bamford will come back into this team. I think they could probably cope without Ayling, in the sense that actually Dallas has had some better games in that position recently. But Bamford, I think, has to be at nine. That's something they've got to get back to. But yeah, I always feel with Leeds that when the width works, Leeds work.
Is there a chance of that then, of Bamford coming back in? Because he's only really done that game with the 23s, and even then he was forced to stay on beyond the limit of where they wanted him to play because of injuries.
I should allude to this before I came on, but I think I'm right in saying the 23s have got a game tomorrow, have they not? So it might well be that there's another, or sorry, tonight if you're listening on Friday, there might well be another opportunity for them there. But I mean, Bamford did 90 minutes against Manchester City, which wasn't planned, but he came through it. And with Bielsa, it's not always just about the minutes for the 23s. If and I don't know if they have, but if they've gone through Motherwell this week and if the stats are there, then it might well show that they're ready. And I just couldn't see any logic with Bamford in particular. But actually, I basically deep down feel the same about Ayling as well. I couldn't see any logic in keeping him out, given that it's quite glaringly apparent that it would be better to get Bamford back in there.
If he doesn't start, what do you do in terms of the lineup? Do you stick or twist? Do you change it at all?
I think he'll go with Roberts again if Bamford isn't back, because that's what Bielsa tends to do. In terms of the starting lineup, it's become very difficult to guess. I mean, does he think that Rodrigo made enough of a difference on Tuesday to deserve to start? I think it's probably more likely that Firpo will come into the team because Stroik went off with the injury, and I think Stroik could be okay for the weekend, but obviously he is carrying this. I think it's a glute problem that he's had for a little while and was obviously trying to play through on Tuesday night. There won't be massive changes, put it that way, but I think those will be the things that he has to decide. I would have thought, given the way it finished, that it's more likely to be the team in the second half than in the first.
And you're feeling a high scoring home win?
Feeling a game where there will be goals and Leeds will win it.
Interesting that. What are you, Michael? What did you predict over on ours? I forget.
I think
now.
A draw.
Yeah.
I just feel like it's the way this season's going. We're never going to get the full relief of a big game.
Yeah, he was going to say that. I could see it in his body language.
The discussion we had on ours is that we've decimalised the points available, haven't we?
1.2 points.
Let's see. Michael went for 1.2 points. I feel like we're about at the 2-point mark for this game. Like a soft win, if you like.
Yeah, I think that's how I feel. Yeah.
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 So you're just above draw, tending towards win, but I'm more tending towards win.
1.2 points feels like not 0.8 because we'll be a bit.
Oh. You might be ahead of the curve here. Analysts will be doing this in years to come, won't they? Yeah, this is a 1.2 point game. Yeah.
But I mean, I said in the run up to the Palace game, I was really looking forward to it. Was it you that was messaging Phil?
It was,
you said,
yeah.
I'm glad you said that because everybody's basically shitting themselves.
Yes.
But I said, so long since I've seen Leeds under the lights and in the Premier League, and I did really enjoy it. And had we not been started, you know, the day in 17th or whatever, I probably would have enjoyed it even more, because that anxiety just gnaws away at you, doesn't it? You can't help it. But it's just been brilliant being in there, and I'm really looking forward to Sunday as well.
I always think that when it comes to the games where the pressure is on and the games that are a bit horrible to kind of endure are the games that you remember and the games that you actually enjoy most. Mm. I mean, how many games did we have in various seasons where it amounted to nothing and was never going to amount to nothing, and the season was already done and there was zero risk of going down, but there was only the faintest chance of getting into the playoffs, and usually not even that. This is what makes football good.
I think it was telling that on after the game the other night, I think I was awake till about 2-3
for me, yeah.
And Twitter was so lively. There were loads of people obviously still up and talking about the game at like 1:30, 2:00, and you're thinking, go to bed, everyone. Yeah.
Everyone's doing the same thing. I should be in bed, but I'm not. Yeah, yeah. I was exactly the same, completely wide. Another thing, you're right there. Like, you look back a few years and Elland Road is not full, and you find yourself during games, you'd be glancing around and see a clump of empty seats, and you were wishing it was full. You were wishing there was more of an atmosphere. You can take your eyes off the game. Maybe you're looking, I don't know, at the pigeons on the West Stand roof, whatever it might be, inspecting where the floodlights are. This stuff, you can't take your eyes off it for a minute. I'm kicking every ball and I absolutely love it.
I keep saying on Twitter that it's like a playoff semi every single game, especially at home. I mean, away from home, it's more like a game that you can't wait to get away from. You know, like Southampton and Brighton and so on. But they've been better at Elland Road. There is definitely a distinction, I think, between the home form and the away form. And for some reason, every game at Elland Road just ends up feeling or being massively on edge and feeling kind of monumental in a way that it really shouldn't at this stage of the season. I thought that about Wolves. I mean, I still, when I look back at that, I can't believe the atmosphere towards the end of that for what was a 1-1 draw with a pretty mediocre and negative Wolves side. But everybody's, as I say, I think as well, you shouldn't underestimate or fail to give credit to the levels of patience that are being shown. I mean, really, you would have found other clubs, the supporters of other clubs definitely struggling to put up with some of this. And the fact that, because you've had such a high benchmark on the Bielsa of the quality of play and the results, you know, of that creeping fear that this is just going wrong. But it hasn't been like that. People really, really have stuck with it. And I think in a really kind of sadistic way, everybody's loving this season, yeah. Even though it's going to kill us.
Yeah, it's like the worst, best drug in the world, isn't
it?
This?
I think so. I think so. Not good for you long term, yeah. But hey.
Ride the dragon. But I think as well, you know, that we've missed out on so much that we've banked a lot of gratitude as well. People are grateful for where we are now. I think so many football fans, like Brighton booing their players off against us when they were in eighth position at the end of that game or whatever, and the seventh now, and they don't like it. They're ungrateful. It's like, it feels like the Elland Road crowd is just really grateful to be back in there, to be back in the Premier League. And we know, you know, nothing lasts forever in football. And I think there's just a really low level appreciation of that at all times with Bielsa.
There's some interesting generational dynamics going on as well, because there's a whole generation of people in their early 20s experiencing this for the very first time. And then there's people like us who've got now quite faded memories of it. But I think both groups are enjoying it in very different ways, but still...
The same thing.
But still essentially the same thing, yeah. It comes down to. So, whereas, I don't know, it feels like there's just dissatisfaction with being mid-table, which will come at some stage.
I mean, that's the irony, is we want to get to a position this season where we've got nothing to play for, don't we? We want to get to a point where we're going, 10th is great.
That was going to be the gist of my piece prior to the Rafinha goal. And actually, I did say this, that this is just all about survival now. And if survival is done by February, March or whatever, nobody is going to care in the slightest what comes after that. I mean, they enjoy the football and they go to the games and everything else, but people are not going to sit going, well, it'd be great if we could finish 10th, this, that, and other. People just think, let's get to the summer, pack this one away and jobs are good. And there was quite a lot of surprise in the press room watching that Graham Potter interview afterwards, because I don't know much about Potter as a person. You know, I don't know much about his demeanour and his attitude and so on, but he never struck me as the sort of person that would rush into fight with his own supporters or anybody, really. He doesn't seem like that sort. But he'd obviously come away, and I kind of think quite rightly, he'd come away from that game thinking, I'm not having this, you know, I'm not prepared to be asked about this and just say they're entitled to their opinion. But he was very, very spiky in what he said, and it was a real kind of two fingers up to everybody. You know, things like, I'm sorry that we're eighth in the table or whatever. I'm sorry that we're ahead of Manchester United. I'm sorry that we're playing good football. I'm sorry that I'm bringing the kids through. And it was a bit like, jeepers. Yeah,
should have gone full Mick McCarthy. That's what
I think. It was quite close. The thing about McCarthy is that you would sit back and go, oh, it's Mick being Mick, isn't it? Whereas with Potter, I mean, that was a real challenge to his own crowd, and legitimately so, I think. And I do get the frustration this season with the fact that the team hasn't grown at Leeds. It hasn't, you know, and that the recruitment that was done in the summer hasn't helped, you know, hasn't noticeably helped that. But I still feel that if Leeds do finish mid-table, they'll have done what they needed to do. And if they're not lucky to get away with it, then actually what are you criticising particularly? It is kind of what needs to be done. The thing about Leeds is that cannot be the next 10 years. And people at Leeds know that. And I think, again, that is why you will shift towards the 49ers. Because I remember speaking to somebody at the club, I think Kinnear ages ago, where he was talking about in the Premier League, you have sort of break-even models, you know, clubs who try to keep their finances in a good state and try to manage all of that. And there are some clubs where you can do that because the supporters will allow you to do it. You can do it at Leeds for a finite period, but you cannot be 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the line from promotion and still be saying, yeah, we're kind of aiming for 15th this year. You know, Leeds are a club who do have to have longer term ambition, but I don't think that longer term ambition needed to include anything other than just being safe this season.
Well, fingers crossed. At the Phil Hayes Show on Twitter, if you want to say hi to us as well, we'll post some photos and clips and stuff on there for you. You can subscribe to The Athletic, 33% off, theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Back next week then. We'll do it again, same time, same place. We'll speak to you then.
The Phil Hay Show.